Okay, so good evening, everybody, and welcome again. Welcome to the fourth part of our Shavua Shel Torah. Just to remind everybody that all the recordings from the entire week are up both on our Facebook page and on the website of Magen Avot. It's really been a great series, and we're very excited tonight to end off on a high note as well. I'm just going to introduce Shelvi Friedman, who is originally from South Africa, a graduate of Nishmat, and has spent many years teaching in various institutions in Israel. She currently works as a senior educator in Aish, as well as teaching in Hasmonean, and is a fellow on the Nishmat Yo'etzet Halakha program. And Shelvi is going to be speaking tonight about From Shir HaShirim to Rut, A Staircase to Heaven.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the introduction. Thank you everybody for joining and for being here. If you are feeling brave or kind, then please turn on your video. I know some people are cooking for Yantav and some people are doing other things at the same time, but it certainly is much easier to teach faces as opposed to blank screens. So if you would like to, I strongly encourage you to turn on your screen so we can share not just Torah together, but also enjoy the pleasure of seeing other grown-ups, because I spent all day with my children, basically. Okay, so I don't have much time, and we have a lot of material to cover, so I'm going to just get right into it. I will, at some point, be screen sharing, because there is a source sheet, but in the meantime, just a little bit of background. Thank you for everyone who did turn on their screens. So no pressure for those who did it, really no pressure. The Shavuot is a very strange festival. It's strange on a couple of counts. The first thing that's incredibly bizarre about Shavuot is that it is the only Jewish festival which doesn't have a specific mitzvah involved. You know, Pesach, we have matzah, we have the mitzvah, the rabbinic mitzvah of 4 cups of wine. We have so many layers of mitzvahs involved in Pesach. Sukkot, we go into the sukkah, we shake the lulav and esrog. Rosh Hashanah, we blow the shofar. Yom Kippur, we're fasting. I mean, even the rabbinic mitzvahs, the rabbinic festivals, even Purim and Chanukah have mitzvahs that totally take up every minute of the day. And what do we have on Shavuot? Customs, right? We have minhagim, we have customs. My 4-year-old was telling me as she was falling asleep the difference between a mitzvah and a minhag. We have a custom to have cream cheese, but she very proudly told me that she doesn't need to have the cream cheese because it's not a mitzvah to have cream cheese and to have cheesecake, right? And in the same way, we have this custom to stay up all night, which is simply just a custom. There are no mitzvahs connected to the Shavuot experience. So the first question of the night is why? Why is Shavuot a mitzvahless festival? That's going to be the first question. The second question goes as follows. Did you know that Shavuot actually doesn't have a date in the Torah? I don't know what you've spoken about over the last week, but let me just screen share. There we go. But if you at the description of Shavuot, we're told that Pesach is celebrated on the 15th of Nisan. We're told the date of Rosh Hashanah. However, when it comes to Shavuot, it just says you should count for yourself from the day after Shabbos, meaning the day after after the first day of Pesach. So from the second day of Pesach, you're going to count 7 weeks. And on the completion of those 7 weeks, in other words, once you get to the end of the 49 days, at the beginning of the 50th day, that's when you will celebrate this festival, which, as you can see in Devarim, is called Chag HaShavua, the Festival of Weeks. So the second question is, why is it that Shavuot has no specific date given to it? Why is it simply the festival that's 49 days after the second day of Pesach? And the third question, and hopefully with this we'll launch into some answers, the third question is the name itself. The name is a very, very strange name for a festival, the Festival of Weeks, Shavuot. Why weeks? Why can't we come up with a more creative name for the perhaps the most important of all the festivals, the date we celebrate the giving of the Torah? So we have three questions to recap. Question number one, why are there no mitzvahs connected to Shavuot? Question number two, why is Shavuot not dated in the Torah? And question number three, why is it called the Festival of Weeks? So to answer that question, we have to really acknowledge the following. Really intrinsically, Shavuot is an extension of the Pesach experience. If Shavuot's date is so bound up to the counting that led from Pesach to Shavuot, then really they're two bookends of an experience. The one end of the experience is Pesach. We have a 49-day counting of 7 times 7 in the middle, and the second bookend of the experience is Shavuot. There is a beginning, there is a middle, and there's an end. And if that's the case, then if we truly want to understand what Shavuot is about, we have to start with Pesach. Because Shavuot can't be understood without understanding, without taking a look at Pesach. And taking a look at Pesach, and then the counting, and then finally Shavuot itself. And I want to suggest that one of the ways of really understanding the transition or the journey that we're going through from Pesach to Shavuot is to look at the books that are read on those days. We know that there are 5 Megillot, there are 5 scrolls, which we have the custom of reading. It's interesting, right? There's three kind of levels of Torah that is read in shul. And I think we're all starting to miss shul, I think more and more as the weeks go by. But there's the Torah itself, which is read, the Chumash, right? The first piece of Tanakh, which we read in shul. Then we read a piece of the Haftarah, which is from the Nih part of Tanakh, the Navi, the prophets. And then on 5 very special times in the year, we get to read from the Chah part of Tanakh, from Ketuvim, from the writings of divine inspiration. And we read them 5 times a year. On Tisha B'Av, we read the book of Eicha, right? On Sukkot, we read the book of Kohelet. On Purim, we all know we read the story of Esther. On Purim, we read the story of Esther. And on Pesach, we read the book of Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, and Shavuot, the book of Rut. And as you can see, I brought the Ramah of Moshe Isilis, the great Sfaradi Pasek in the Shulchan Aruch. I didn't finish translating this one. This is called the half-baked soul sheet. There must have been a child crying or something. So the Ramah says we have the custom to read Shir HaShirim on Shabbos Chol HaMoed of Pesach. Unfortunately, we missed that too this year. And then finally, at the end of the experience on V'Nohagin, we are accustomed to read Rut, the book of Rut, on Shavuot. It's okay, I don't need it. Thanks. And this is based in the Abu Draham is the one who originally teaches this, and he discusses the reason why we read those, and there's some fascinating and really obscure reasons why we read the books and the dates that we do. But I'd like to suggest the following. If we really want to understand the journey from Pesach to Shavuot, as we said, we need to understand what Pesach is, what Shavuot is, and maybe by looking at the books that are read on these two events, the book that we read on Pesach and the book that we read on Shavuot, the Megillah that's read at each of these ends of this journey, then perhaps we can understand the journey in its entirety. So let's start by looking at the book of Shir HaShirim, the book we read on Pesach. Shir HaShirim is an incredible romance. Shir HaShirim, in fact, is so sensual in its writings that the rabbis felt, and the Gemara Megillah discusses, perhaps it shouldn't be written. I'm just going to stop for a second. They felt that perhaps it shouldn't be written in the Tanakh. We shouldn't put it as part of the Tanakh. It is so descriptive in the passionate love between these two protagonists that the rabbis felt maybe it shouldn't be written. And in the end, it was decided it should be put in Tanakh because it's so critical to understand how to develop this relationship with God, which ultimately we're trying to achieve, that we should keep this as part of Tanakh. If I had to sum up the book of Shir HaShirim, it's a story of two lovers. The one love, I'm telling you, the whole of Hollywood and the whole of Disney and the whole of everything is built on the Tanakh. You just have to learn Tanakh, and then you will know every genre of movie that you could possibly know. Shir HaShirim is your typical, I mean, perhaps that's the source of it all. Tell me how many stories you can tell that are built around this model. Shir HaShirim is a romance novel about a princess, a maiden who is stuck in her castle. And she peers out of her castle longing to be with her beloved. Her beloved is not an ogre. Her beloved is a shepherd. Her beloved is a shepherd who's out frolicking in the fields. Midaleg al harim makabet al hagvot. He's out in the fields. He is free. He is amongst the apple trees. And this maiden, all she wants to do is be able to escape from the confines of her prison and get out and be with her beloved. And 5 times in the story, she tries to escape. She tries time and time again to escape. And each time the guards of the prison find her, they capture her, and they throw her back in a room in a tower. What is the nimshal? What is the story really about? There are two ways of understanding the book of Shir HaShirim. Either we can say, and this is how Rashi explains the story, that the story of Shir HaShirim is the story of the Jewish people. We, the Jewish people, are on a constant quest to reunite with our Creator. We're on a constant journey to try to get back to the land of Israel, get back to our home. And every single time we almost make it to that desirable state of being close to God in our own land, we mess everything up. We get caught by the gods and thrown back in. Right, whether it's we leave the land of Egypt, we go get the Torah at Mount Sinai, we're about to go into the land of Israel, and then bam, we have the story of the 12 spies and they mess everything up. Or if it's the story of Shlomo HaMelech, who builds the first temple and everything is so awesome and everything is incredible, and then bam, we have a civil war and everything gets messed up. Or maybe it's the time of Ezra, when all the Jews had the opportunity to return to the land of Israel, rebuild the second temple. And ultimately, Ezra could have been Mashiach, the Midrash tells us. And yet, the Jews choose not to come. And the Jews who do come to the land of Israel end up assimilating and not keeping Shabbos and not respecting the laws. And bam, we mess it up. And time again, this happens. On this thread, Rav Soloveitchik wrote one of the most powerful and terrifying books. He wrote a book called Kol Dodi Dofek, The Voice of My Beloved Knocks, which we'll see is actually a verse from Shir HaShirim. And in it, he describes the eight knocks, the eight ways that God knocked at our door with the establishment of the state of Israel. And he says, and did we not hear the knocking and go and manage to escape from the chambers and get out into and get out into the fields, get out and get back home into the land of Israel? But there is another way of viewing the story of Shir HaShirim. Yes, perhaps Shir HaShirim is the story of the Jewish nation. But on a more personal level, the story of Shir HaShirim is the story of the Jew. It's the story, it's my story, it's your story, it's each and every single one of our stories. The book of Shir HaShirim is a story about a Jew who is confined in the four walls of reality, the four walls of physicality. And deep down inside this Jew is a deep yearning, a yearning to experience something that goes beyond the confines of this world. I don't know if you've ever experienced this, ever stood in shul during the Ilah service or a Kol Nidre service. Walked out of the gates of Auschwitz singing Am Yisrael Chai. Stood at the Kotel and prayed and felt a connection to the people around you, praying around you. Danced in a circle at a wedding. There are so many moments where we feel, and I'm going to sound a bit weird over here, but you feel this experience almost like this feeling that I'm feeling inside of me. It can't be a physical experience that I'm experiencing. In fact, I feel like I want to rip off the physical constraints of my own body in order to experience this feeling in its entirety, to see the absolutely powerful and awesome experience that I'm feeling right now. That, it says the Malbim, is the story of Shir HaShirim. Time and time again, the princess, the Jew, tries to escape the confines of reality in order to experience something uplifting and holy, something otherworldly. And time again, she fails. Until we get to the climax of the entire book of Shir HaShirim, the fifth chapter. The fifth chapter, for the first time in the book, it's not she who is trying to escape, but he finally comes to her. And she's lying in her bed. Back to screen share. She's lying in her bed. She is asleep. And here we hear, Ani yishena v'libi'er. I am asleep and my heart is awake. And as I said, this describes the dichotomy of the human being. On the one hand, her body is asleep, but inside there's something pulsating through her veins that is pushing her, urging her to feel something higher, to experience something higher. And what happens? Kol Dodi Dofek, he comes to her and he knocks at her door. And as I said, that phrase, Kol Dodi Dofek, is something which there have been, I don't know how many books written called Kol Dodi Dofek. And he says, Pitrili, open for me. He begs her. He says, my beloved, I'm here. You've been yearning for me for all of these past four chapters of the book. I'm here. I've come to you. Open for me. Rayati yonatit mati. Open me a perfection, my dove, my beloved. Shiroshinim leital. My hair is filled with dew. There's two ways of viewing the hair filled with dew. The one is, I'm getting wet. Open the door, right? It's pouring with rain outside. But the other one is, dew is always a sign of bracha. It's always a sign of blessing. What the beloved is saying is, I have so much good for you. I have so much blessing. It's falling off like droplets off my head. Open the door. I can give you this bracha. And here comes the tragedy of humanity. At this point, we have an opportunity where God knocks at our own door. Proverbial doors of our heart. And what does she say? She says, no, she says, Pashatzi et kutotai, I've taken off my cloak. How can I put it on again? Rachatzi et ragla, I've washed my feet. How am I going to get them dirty again? And here we have, the Midrash picks up on this word echecha. Hidden in this word echecha is echa, right? Echa is the timeless cry of the Jew who has failed. It's the same word that Hashem says to Adam in the Garden of Eden, Ayeka, where are you? It's the cry of Yirmiyahu, of Jeremiah, as he watches the first temple be destroyed. Echa yashva bodad, how alone, how barren, how tragic is the city? And here she says the same word, Echechal bishana, how can I, God, how can I get up? And the Midrashim also point out that the word katontai, my cloak, is really, really linked into the idea of a ketonet. The ketonet is what the Kohen used to wear. What she's saying is not, I'm in my PJs, I don't feel like getting up. She's saying, I no longer wear the clothing of the Kohen Gadol. I no longer wear that which proves me meritorious of a relationship with you, God. I can't do it because I'm undeserving of it. I can't open the door for you. And he puts his hand through the door and she sees him, and suddenly her insides churn and she doesn't know what to do, and she runs up to open the door for him. And obviously she has some sort of nighttime routine. Her hands are covered in myrrh, covered in like oils. And she tries to open the door and her hand slips over the doorknob. And by the time she finally opens the door, tragically, Dodicha Makavar, he's gone. The book of Shir HaShirim, at the beginning of our journey from Pesach to Shavuot, describes a passionate love, a clarity, a vision, an excitement, which ultimately crumbles into tragedy when she opens the door and he is gone. Now let's stop and let's skip out the 49 days in the middle. We'll revisit those and let's look at the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth, unfortunately, has a bad reputation for being a book about the laws of Yibum. Right, Yibum is some like really difficult to understand. The Ramban says it's all about reincarnations. It's this like really bizarre structure whereby if a man dies without having any children, his wife can marry the closest relative, and then the soul of the brother can perhaps relive inside the we're talking like weird, out of this world kind of stuff, right? The story of Ruth on the surface is a story about a Moabite princess who chooses to give up the life of a Moabite princess to become the Nebach, the poor daughter-in-law of a poor widowed Jewish woman, Naomi. She goes out into the field to glean from the leftover wheat that's left for the poor people of the community. And while she is there, there's a man called Boaz. He happens to be the greatest rabbi of the generation. He happens to be an incredibly successful and wealthy man. And he says, don't worry, I'll take care of you. She goes home and Naomi says, well, which field did you go to? And she says, I went to the field of Boaz. And Naomi goes white. And Naomi says, oh my gosh, he's your closest relative. He's the guy you can do yibum with. You should marry him so you can continue on the life, the soul of your deceased husband. And when they tell the story to children, and I've listened to my children on their Zoom classes with their teacher all week, they kind of skip to the next bit. And they go, and so they got married and all lived happily ever after. What they miss is, again, an incredibly inappropriate part of the story. I see why they miss it, right? But it's one of the most important pieces of the story. And I'm going to read it with you right now. Ruth is, this is in the third chapter of the book of Ruth. She is one day she's done her gleaning, they have their wheat, and Naomi says to her, now's your chance, right? Now's your chance. It's time for you to go and be with Boaz. And she instructs her. She says, Barachatz, you should wash. And the Midrashim say, you should go to the mikveh. You should do everything. You always get a little bit nervous when a Jew says to you, don't worry, everything's glatt kosher, right? This is the everything's glatt kosher moment. It says, go to the mikveh, prepare everything. We know halachically you're meant to be together because of this law of Yibum. Prepare yourself, get dressed in your best clothing, your wedding dress, right? And go down to the goring, go down to the threshing floor, because he is going to be there. And apparently, and I know nothing about biblical agriculture, well, not nothing, but I know very little about biblical agriculture, but apparently when it's threshing season, the owner of the threshing floor sleeps on the threshing floor and doesn't go home that night. So he is going to be there and he'll be alone. Now's a good time. So she says, everything that you tell me to do, I will do. She is a good and, what's the English word? She's a good, can't think of the word. She is a blanking out. She listens to her instructions. She does what she's told to do. She says, absolutely, as you command me, mother-in-law, so I shall do. And she goes down, and just as her mother-in-law commanded her. This is a very ritualistic story on the one hand. She's doing what she's commanded. She's doing what she's told. She's making sure everything is glatt kosher. And Boaz is fast asleep. And can you imagine? Just imagine the scene. Imagine you're talking about the greatest rabbi of the generation. You're talking about the head of the Sanhedrin. You're talking about a chief rabbi, yeah? And so, and she, he goes down, and what does she do? She opens up his, she reveals his feet, right? It's a good way to wake someone up, is to make them feel cold. And he wakes up in the middle of the night. Can you imagine the scene? There is a woman at the bottom of his bed, right? And he freaks out. And he says, Miat, what are you doing here? Who are you? And she says, don't worry. She says, everything is glatt kosher, right? She says, it's me. It's Rus. Don't you remember we met on the when I was gleaning from fields? Don't worry. You keep Ga'elata. You are my redeemer. This is what we're obligated to do. Let's be together. Now this will be the end of our marriage process and we'll be married. And his answer is incredibly bizarre. Firstly, he says, wow. He says, I am so honored. Right? He says, Brucha at la Hashem, blessed you should be to Hashem. Thank you for doing this big kindness with me. He said, you could have gone to marry any young boy and you chose to marry me. Keeping in mind, she couldn't have married any young boy. She was a poor, penniless Moabite convert. She didn't exactly have a pick of matches that people weren't running down and banging down doors to get to her. And he says, but you know what? He says, there might be another person who is a closer relative to you than I am. So I can't be with you because it's not as glatt kosher as you said it is. You're right. We seem to have everything lined up. There's one piece missing, which is the fact that there might be a closer relative. Would you mind sleep at the bottom of my bed? I won't lay a finger on you. And in the morning, we'll go and we'll find this relative and ask him if he minds if we get married. And she agrees. And that's what happens. And she wakes up early in the morning. And as I said, you really don't need to watch romance movies. You don't need to read romance novels. You just need to learn Tanakh. She slips out in the morning before anyone could see them. And in the morning they go, they sort out their situation and they decide to get married and they live happily ever after, whatever that means. Very strange story. But the truth is, if we have to reread the story from it, we need to reread the story from a different context. Because if Shir HaShirim is a story of passion, of love, that doesn't come to its fruition, that doesn't come to its fulfillment, Ruth, too, is a story of passion and love. Can you imagine the scene? Boaz is the wealthiest rabbi, as we said, of the generation. He's a businessman. He is a rabbi. You can be both. I guess you could be both in those days. He comes to his field to watch the gleaners. He has hundreds of poor people who are picking up the spare bits of wheat. He has all of his workers at the side. He has a lot going down, right? And he walks in to oversee everything. And his eyes, it's literally seen from a movie. His eyes skim the room and he looks across and he calls over his manager and he says, who's she? Right? He picks her from across a crowd. He says, who's that woman? Right? And the Midrashim go at length to try to describe what is it about Rus that grabs his eye from that first instant. Maybe it's right, all of these different ideas. What does he see? But ultimately, it's love at first sight. He sees her in his eyes and he walks up to her and he greets her. And I didn't bring in this pet text, but you can look it up. You can read it over the story over Shavuot. He says to her, thank you for coming. He says, you're so kind. He keeps describing her kindness and her kindness. He says, please, do you mind? Can you come back? Can you come glean back at my fields? Will you please? In fact, I'll let you use my mill and I'll make your wheat into flour and I'll feed you and I'll take care of you, whatever you need. Can you see what's going on here? This is a budding romance. And again, she comes down now. If we understand this couple and they have these, you don't have to be a very close reader of the text to see the sparks in the conversation between Boaz and Ruth. There is something going on. There's an energy between them. The words that they use, the sensitivity, the refinement, and finally in the climax of the story, just like we had at the peak of the story where he comes to her in the book of Shir HaShirim, we have the opposite. She comes to him in the peak of the story in the book of Ruth. She comes to him in the middle of the night. She knocks on the door. She comes in and she says, open for me. Let's be together. And the difference here is what Boaz answers. Boaz, as you can imagine, is, and you can see again in his response to her, he says, you could have married anyone. You chose to marry me. You chose to be with me, right? You can see the love that's forming between them. And he says to her, you're right. Can you imagine how much they want to be together? It's the middle of the night. There is no one there. No one will know. As I said, she's been to the mikveh. Everything is kosher. And he says to her, you know, there's one halachic thing we need to look into before we do anything. Do you mind tomorrow? We need to go speak to the Sanhedrin about this one halachic issue that we need to organize, we need to deal with. What on earth? Talk about romantic. Where's the romance, right? That moment where you're going to whip out your Shulchan Aruch, you're going to whip out your code of Jewish law and try to work out what the halacha is of what you're meant to do now. This is a romantic story. What are you... The underlying current of the book of Ruth is different from the underlying current of the book of Jerusalem. Shirash Shirim is undilated, absolutely passionate love. The book of Ruth is structured, calculated, thought out, and passionate love. And the difference is very clear. The way that Ruth comes to fruition, the way that Ruth and Boaz land up together in a way that the two beloveds in the book of Shirash Shirim don't, is because ultimately there is something underlying the love of Ruth, and that's called consistency. Consistency and commitment together with passion is a love that is far more lasting, that is far deeper than just the passion alone. And now we can stop and understand what happens. We go through the Pesach experience, and if you stop for a moment and imagine in your own personal year that Pesach experience, it's the Shir HaShirim. It's the diamond of our Jewish experiences. Think about your childhood Pesach Seders, and you stand and you sing the Manishtana, and you have the Matzah. We have this overwhelmingly beautiful, powerful experience. And you know what happens the next day? It's like the day after. Do you know how many people I have stood in Auschwitz with? Students who've stood in the gas chambers, and I work in outreach, and I work with all sorts of different types of Jews. Students who've said, my grandparents, my great-grandparents died as Jews. I am going to choose to live as a Jew. I can't begin to tell you how many of those students go on to intermarry and to marry non-Jews and to raise non-Jewish children. Because the passion of Shir HaShirim, the passion of those powerful Jewish memories, those powerful moments we discussed, the ne'ilas and the kol nidres of our life, the kotel moments of our Jewish experiences, those are powerful moments. But the problem with those moments is that they do not last. They fade away. You ever decided to go on a diet? In that moment of absolute clarity, you're going to go on a diet, and then you open the grocery cupboard and you look at the chocolate bar, right? We've all made commitments from a moment of passion. And then you wake up. You wake up back in the four walls of reality. The soldiers throw you back into your castle, and you carry on with the rest of your life. So Torah instructs, you know what you should do the next day? You should start counting. Start counting. You're going to count 7 days, 7 weeks. Keep counting. Counting shows commitment. In fact, the whole of Alcoholics Anonymous is built on this whole system of you counting your days. How many days have you been clean? How many months have you been clean? You get the little tokens. How many tokens do you have to show how long you've been clean for? Counting shows I'm in this for the long run. I'm in this when things are not inspirational, when things are not passionate. There's a discussion in the Talmud about what the most important verse in the Torah is. And you would think the most important verse of the Torah is, I don't know, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, V'ahavta L'Reicha Kamocha. The Talmud discusses and debates some of these and decides, no, the most important verse in the Torah is the verse describing the Korban Tamid, the Korban, the sacrifice which is given every single day, the daily sacrifice. The verse says you should give a sacrifice in the morning and give a sacrifice in the afternoon. There's nothing super exciting about this. It's like keves echad, the same sheep that you offered this morning, you'll offer it in the afternoon. And the next day you're going to go on and do the same thing. Commitment. And so we count 7 weeks, 7 days, again and again. We keep counting until we get to Shavuot. In other words, Shavuot is not simply a festival where we celebrate the giving of the Torah. And Shavuot does have a specific mitzvah. Remember, I started off and I said, you know, there's no special mitzvah to Shavuot. There is. It's the 49 days that came before it. Shavuot is built on the commitment of 49 days. Shavuot doesn't have a date of its own because it is not a real day without the commitment that came before, without the daily grind, right? The definition of love, Rabbi Noach Olowick says, the definition of love is someone who's worth doing hard things for. I'm committed for the long run. On my parents' 25th wedding anniversary, I went with my father to buy an anniversary present for my mother. And we're standing at the mall together. And I looked at my father and I said, so, I said, is she the one? And he was startled by the question. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, it's been 25 years. Is she the one? And he said, you know, he said, she was the one on the day that I married her. And I chose to make her the one every day since. That's Shavuot. The book of Shira Shirim, the experience of Pesach, is the day I married her. It's the passion. It's the love. But Shavuot, when we turn around and we say, have I chosen to make this the core of my life? Have I chosen to commit to this in a way that's structured and bounded, where I give constraints to my passions so that it can be expressed in a way that is healthy, in a way that's committed, in a way that's long-lasting? And perhaps that's why Shavuot doesn't have a specific mitzvah. Because the celebration of Torah is not celebrated by the trumpeting of a shofar or the eating of matzah. The real celebration of Torah is day and night. Right? Learning Torah day and night, experiencing that Torah day and night, that onwards commitment going forward, that's the real and the truest celebration of the Torah. And so there's no mitzvahs to this day. Can we sit and can we enjoy the Torah learning without having a special highlight, without having a passionate moment, and find passion even within the structure of something which appears to be regular, like a regular Shabbat day perhaps, on the outside? So just to sum up, we spoke about the journey that we've been through. We've been through a long journey, and it feels longer this year than ever before. We've been through a long journey from Pesach to Shavuot, from Shira Shirim to Rus, from passion to structure. And hopefully we can go into Matan Torah, we can go into accepting the Torah tomorrow night and over the Shavuot experience and over the Shavuot period with a clarity, with a sincerity, with a sense of commitment and a sense of consistency, which will please God. Take the Torah that we learn on Shavuot and really enhance our lives going forward. I wish you all a Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach, and thank you. Thank you very much. It was really a great way to end the series, really, as I said at the beginning, but we already ended off on a high over here. And thank you for that. Thank you, Shalvi. Just to remind everybody, all these shirim are available on our website. People want to, you know, get in there in the last minute, just recap and prepare for Shavuot. Also, tomorrow morning, please join us. We advertise on the newsletter for the Bring Your Own Cheesecake Party. And there will be at 9:30 in the morning a story time for the kids. But after that, really, it's just a chance for the community to get together. Obviously, we won't have any Zoom events on Shavuot itself. So please join us. I'll be speaking briefly, and we'll also have a reading of the Aseret HaDibrot, the closest that we can have. I think that's it. Just if there's any questions, or Shalvi, maybe based on the share on what we've had, if anybody has any questions, comments that we make, now's the time.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Shalvi. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. That was excellent.
Thank you. Thank you. Chag Sameach, everybody.
Thank you, Shalvi.